Welcome on into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry, you know that I am an award-nominated sports
yes,
journalist.
You are now. And I voted for you, by the way. So there you go.
It's a story for another day, folks. I'm not a sports journalist, really. Mm-hmm. Well, I do like the Eagles. I follow sports. And yesterday, everyone was glued to their laptops, their TV, watching Jason Kelce's emotional 40-minute retirement speech. And we're going to use that today as a jumping-off point to talk about Jason Kelce and what he's meant to the city, but also about retirement for athletes, about masculinity in the public forum. We have two great guests, Mike Sielski, Inquirer columnist, and Marcus Smith II, a former teammate of Jason Kelce, a former Eagle, and someone who's talked a lot about mental health and athletes.
Yeah, I will tell you that I cried a little bit.
You cried.
I cried. But, you know, I get you know, crocodile tears on command. But I mean, it was really a sad moment. But at the same time, I'm like so happy for him. 13 years, something to celebrate.
Sure was. It sure was. Today's also Super Tuesday.
It is. Big day.
Big day in politics. And of course, we're also hearing a lot these days about polls.
Yep.
As it seems like the final two have been more or less picked. People believe the polls. They hate the polls. They trust the polls. They distrust the polls. How are polls actually made? What's the science of polling? Are they really less reliable than they used to be?
Yeah, we've been shocked a few times because they were wrong.
They were wrong, kind of. But, of course, the margins are tight with this type of polling. So we're going to talk to a couple of folks. Patrick Murray is at Monmouth. They're a very well-known, pretty highly rated pollster. He's going to tell us about how polls are made. We also have Matt Graham, who's a Temple professor who studies polling and how it's conducted. We'll talk with both of them about the polling industry today. And if you've got thoughts on that
or Kelce,
on Jason Kelce or on my sports journalism expertise,
you might get some emails about
email studio2@whyy.org. Maybe I'll have to tell that story later. 888-477-9499 is the phone number. Now let's talk about some headlines in the news, Cherry, and you will go first today.
Yeah, the Pennsylvania State Police, well, they've opened an internal affairs investigation into an incident between a state trooper and a top city official and her husband. The video showing part of that incident went viral over the weekend, Avi, and the trooper is now on administrative duty. Now, all of this information came out about the status of these investigations during a hearing that the state police had pre-scheduled with the House Appropriations Committee. And during that hearing, several Philly lawmakers, they asked about this viral video. It was recorded by Selena Morrison, the city's director of the mayor's office of LGBTQ affairs. And it shows a state trooper arresting a man she says is her husband. The man is identified as Darius McLean, who is shown handcuffed on the wet ground on I-76. In the video, you hear Morrison yelling that she works for the mayor, and then you see the trooper sort of charge her, and the video gets garbled. But apparently, the trooper stopped Morrison. McLean had been following her and pulled up behind that trooper when Morrison was stopped. And state police said McLean became verbally combative, then refused multiple lawful orders. Now, the viral video, Avi, didn't show what happened leading up to the arrest because there was no body cam footage. And State Representative Ben Waxman from asked about that during yesterday's hearing.
Right now, there's no troopers in Philadelphia County wearing body cameras. Is that correct?
That would be correct.
Okay.
But, sir, to be clear, I would expect that within the next 3 to 4 weeks, you will see them. And within a few weeks after that, they should all be wearing.
Okay. I would just encourage that to happen, you know, as soon as it can, and that for the trust of the public, you know, to be restored and to have an ongoing dialogue with law enforcement, these body cameras are essential, and we'd love to have them in Philadelphia County, you know, as soon as possible. Thank you.
And that's because the state had allocated $44 million to the state troopers to have these body cams on police.
No body camera footage for this incident. And that's because it was a state trooper involved. Okay, interesting. And that's a wrinkle here. So that seems like we may never really know what happened during this stop. And there are no charges yet?
No charges. I mean, the state police have been pushing for resisting arrest, disorderly conduct, among other charges against McLean.
Right.
But the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office has declined to actually pursue those charges at this point. They're instead investigating that incident. But this is going to be a, you know, the incident is going to be a he said, she said sort of situation, because they only have video, which shows part of it. But if we had had that body cam footage, we would have seen all of it. But I will say that the state police have said 3 to 4 weeks. And those state troopers in Philadelphia County will have that. State troopers in the western part of the state already have theirs.
I wonder if 3 to 4 weeks was the original timeline or the now expedited timeline.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll never know. Of course, we mentioned it's Super Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Former President Donald Trump is on the ballot in many states. And that is, of course, in part because of a Supreme Court decision. There was a challenge to him being on the ballot. You guys know the story, right?
Yeah.
Because of his involvement in the insurrection, the actions on January 6th. That Supreme Court decision could have a trickle-down effect here in Pennsylvania, because there was a liberal activist named Gene Stilp who was suing to get U.S. Rep. Scott Perry off of the ballot in Pennsylvania's 10th congressional district because of Perry's involvement in the fake elector scheme and his alleged efforts to overturn Pennsylvania's election certification. I think this was always a long shot lawsuit, but I would imagine now with the Supreme Court decision regarding Trump, who was a far more central figure, I think it's fair to say on that day that this case against Perry probably is not going anywhere in terms of his ballot inclusion.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to go up in smoke. Very interesting case from the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, they've said that, the states cannot bar federal candidates from being on the ballot.
Only
Congress can do that. And they definitely can't have a say over whether someone can run for president. Pretty definitive ruling there. Yeah. So.
Yep. 9-0.
9-0.
With some dissent in terms of how far the opinion went. But yep. 9-0.
Mm-hmm. And moving over to New Jersey.
Sure. We love the Garden State.
We do.
We would not want to neglect the Garden State.
Absolutely not. For golf lover. Do you like golf?
No.
Oh.
Tried it one summer. Really frustrating. Didn't like it.
Okay.
I get why people like it, but no, I don't like it.
Yeah. The bugs love me too much, so I stay off the golf course. But Mike Trout and Tiger Woods, their golf course, got final approval to open in South Jersey. The Vineland Planning Board approved the development for the Trout National, the reserve. It's an 18-hole championship golf course. It'll be at the site of the former Cumberland County sand mine off of Route 55.
That's perfect. They can build the sand traps right there. They got the sand.
It's right there. And the course, of course, is developed by Tiger Woods and Mike Trout. And if you don't know who he is, he's a 3-time American League MVP who happens to be from Millville.
Yeah. Shout out South Jersey.
This course is set to open in 2025. Amenities, Avi, include a wedding chapel, performance training center, a 35,000-square-foot clubhouse, 7 private lodges, and it's going to be swanky, okay?
I just trying to imagine telling your grandkids, I got married at Mike Trout's golf course.
Yeah.
I guess that's a story.
That it could be, but the bigger thing is, shout out to Vineland, because they're going to make a lot of money. It's going to have an economic impact. I mean, golf courses collectively bring in tens of billions of dollars every year.
Not good for the environment.
Not
but
good
maybe
for,
that's a different story.
That's a whole question. But it could have a significant economic impact in Vineland, New Jersey.
It makes me think, what would I build in my hometown if I was as wealthy and prominent as Mike Trout is? Because I think it's cool that he's building this thing where he's from.
Yeah.
I don't think Vineland, New Jersey would be most people's pick for a championship golf course. It's a lovely city.
And this is no shade to you people from Vineland.
Yeah, yeah. Millville, shout out Millville, Vineland. But I think, he's doing it because this is where he's from.
Yeah.
So it made me think, if I had that type of status and money, what would I go back and build in my hometown to leave my legacy?
I have no idea.
You don't have an answer?
I don't have an answer either. I got to give
LeBron
this some
James
thought.
Built a school in his hometown, Akron, Ohio, which I thought was really, really cool. Because that's like leaving a legacy for the next generation.
Maybe a library?
A library?
I used to spend a lot of time
Cherry
in the library.
The Cherry T. Gregg Library.
Yeah,
I could see
I may
that.
Even name it after my grandma.
Ooh,
something like that.
I like that.
Grandma or something.
I might open a 24-hour diner.
Ooh,
diners. I love diners. They basically need to be subsidized now, the 24-hour ones, because they can't keep them open. And it would be cool to have a community meeting spot.
And you do love some food, man.
I do love some food. So, I also love Taylor Swift.
Don't we all?
Okay. So the FCC requires that we mention a Kelce brother and Taylor Swift in every single segment that we do, which is why we're going to mention that Ancestry.com has found evidence that Taylor Swift from West Reading, Pennsylvania, is distantly related to famed poet Emily Dickinson.
Wow.
They are sixth cousins, three times removed. What are your thoughts on that, Cherry?
Well, I think it's kind of cool. And she's kind of been hinting that she had some poetic connections. Yeah, that's what people have, Swifties have been saying that.
Swifties will say anything.
Yeah, they've been saying that. And, you know, her new album is called The Tortured Poets
Swifties,
Department.
I love you, but, like, they see, like, they'll see, like, random letters on a wall and read, like, the Bible into it.
And I think one of her songs had the word forevermore, which a word that was also used by Emily Dickinson in one of her poems. So that's probably why that line was drawn,
that
among other incidents.
But they both used the word forevermore. Didn't Edgar Allan Poe use that word, too? Okay, well, I guess I would like to just point out briefly that there's a far cooler Taylor Swift ancestral connection, which is that her direct great-great-grandfather was a really prominent Philadelphian named C.C.A. Baldy, Charles Baldy, who him and his family were among the most prominent and connected Italian Americans of the late 1800s and early 1900s in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Some people called him the King of Little Italy, C.C.A. Baldy.
Oh.
There's a school named after him in Philadelphia. Very interesting figure. And he's not a sixth cousin in this case.
This is direct.
Direct. Great-great-grandfather, C.C.A. Baldy. You can Google him. He's a really interesting guy.
So she comes from interesting stock then.
She sure does. She sure does.
So there you go, Swifties. Another tidbit for you, courtesy of the one and only
After I
Avi
made the fatal
Wolfman
mistake of insulting
Harris.
Them. This is the end. I'm glad Facebook's down today.
And so let's move on, because everybody, Avi, has been talking about Jason Kelce's emotional press conference yesterday where he announced his plan to retire from the Eagles after 13 years. It was incredibly moving watching him trying to just get the words out between the tears. I had a couple crocodile tears come down just listening to him.
Yeah, not a dry eye in the house. Jason Kelce has meant so much to the team and to Philly sports fans, and it's hard for any of us to imagine what it takes to step back from a sport you've been doing since you were a kid. We want to talk about all that now. Kelce's career, the emotion he showed, and what it takes to walk away from the game. With us now is Marcus Smith II, former Eagles player. Welcome to Studio 2, Marcus.
Hey, thank you, man, for having me. I appreciate you guys having me on.
We appreciate you joining. We also have Mike Sielski, sports columnist from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Mike, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, Avi. Hi, Cherry. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Mike, I want to start with you because that Jason Kelce announcement, I mean, definitely emotional. So many fans tearing up. You were there. What was your reaction in real time?
I was moved, too, as somebody who has covered Jason for a long time here in Philadelphia, gotten to know him a little bit over the course of that time. I think you guys framed it really well. I think it was an indication of how hard it can be for a professional athlete, particularly one who plays professional football, as Marcus did. Marcus knows this much better than I do. How hard it can be to give that up and walk away, especially when you're as accomplished as Jason is. I mean, you're talking about a player. Take away the sentimentality and the connection that he has to the city and the region and the Eagles and all of that. You're talking about a guy who's going to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in a few years. I mean, he's one of the best centers ever to play the game. He's one of the best players in Eagles history. And then you add on top of that, I think, a personality that kind of shined through yesterday, that showed how much he cares about the city, how much he cares about the team, all that kind of stuff. I don't see how someone could watch that and not – at a certain level be moved to some degree.
Marcus, your career overlapped with Jason Kelce. What was it like for you watching that and watching the reaction to it from Philly sports fans?
Man, it was super hard to watch just because I know Jason. I got to play with him 3 years. I know the way that he uses that to be able to move for the game. I think that he is a pillar in the Philadelphia Eagles community, but also he plays the game in a way that not a lot of centers or that I know of play the game. So I know it's super hard. It also brings up how I left too as well, and the feelings and the emotions actually stepping away from the game, something that you've been playing your whole entire life, something that's gave you the fortitude to be able to take care of your family, also develop friendships of owners, general managers, people that have helped you tremendously along the way. Mm-hmm. That's tough to be able to go up there and say, like, you know what, I'm finished playing. I don't know what the next thing is for me, because we oftentimes have this helmet on for as long as we have it on. And we don't know necessarily what it looks like when we take the helmet off, because people know us one way.
Yeah.
So we have to continue to just find our identity in another way. And that could be scary at times and tough. So I understand exactly what he's going through. And man, I almost shed a tear myself just watching. I had to watch it two times because I really felt where he was and how he is, especially with his family and being able to walk away in the right way.
Mm. So we're coming up on a break here, but I just want to set this up for the other side of the break. Yeah. Wilson, you mentioned the tears there, Marcus, and when we come back from this break, it would be great to talk about some of those expressions of public emotion and how that wraps into the athlete mentality. So we're going to do that on the other side of a quick break. We're speaking with Marcus Smith II, former Philadelphia Eagles linebacker and a global ambassador for All Points North. His podcast is The Circle of M, about breaking mental health stigmas. We also have on the line Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Stick with us on Studio 2. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarant.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Philadelphia Eagles center Jason Kelce announced his retirement at a very emotional press conference yesterday. And if you are just joining us, we are here with Mike Sielski, Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist, and Marcus Smith II, former Eagles linebacker turned mental health advocate. They are helping us better understand what happens to pro athletes like Kelce after retirement.
If you have thoughts on this topic or just Jason Kelce in general, give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org.
And so I want to just take us back to this press conference a little bit by playing a clip. Take a listen. This is Jason Kelce.
We did almost everything together. Competed, fought, laughed, cried, and learned from each other. We invented games, imagined ourselves as star players of that time. We'd envision making the winning plays day after day on Coulee Ridge Road. We won countless Super Bowls in our minds before ever leaving the house.
Wow. That is Jason Kelce talking about his brother Travis, how they kind of grew up together in this game. And Mike and Marcus, I want to bring you both and talk about this because Mike specifically, I mean, Jason had a very unique style of play. Marcus alluded to that. One of the best centers to ever play the game. But he kind of willed this into existence, and because he wasn't always the best player.
No, you're right, Cherry. And in fact, he didn't become center until he got to college. He walked on at the University of Cincinnati. And the idea of him developing into a Hall of Fame offensive lineman when he got there was a long shot, to say the least. But he had a coach who recommended that he move to center. And the thing that you and your listeners should understand, if they don't already know, is that center is really the nerve center, so to speak, of the entire offensive line and in some ways the entire offense. You often find that offensive linemen and defensive linemen are often the smartest players on an NFL team. They have to know everything about their offense and defense. Jason was so intelligent that he made for a perfect center. And that was a big reason why he was successful as he was with the Eagles. Combine that with a level of athleticism and speed that he played with that most offensive linemen don't have. It became kind of customary to see him blocking smaller players 5-10 yards down the field and running alongside an Eagles running back because he was that fast and that athletic. And put that combination together as he develops physically, mentally, and emotionally, and you get the player that Eagles fans have seen for the last 13 years.
Yeah, and quick follow-up to you, Marcus, on that very topic. I mean, you've talked about the bubble that you almost have to live in when you're playing in the NFL and professional sports. How, describe that bubble, what it's like, and sort of developing your craft in the way that Jason Kelce was able to do that to find so much success.
Yeah, the NFL is a demanding sport. Obviously, we know that we play every Sunday, but through the weeks, you are practicing Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. You're practicing all week. And in order to perfect your craft in a way that you want to perfect, you have to put your all into that sport. I always say the Kobe mentality. If you look at Kobe and his trajectory and his legacy was, hey, I put my all into this sport so I can get everything out of it. And that was Jason Kelce in a nutshell. He put all of his efforts into the sport. He developed friendships. He developed a great sense of alignment around him. And pushing to that, when you are in that bubble and that's all you do, mm-hmm. and you know that you're going to have a new season each and every year, you know that you're going to be able to go out there and get that same type of feeling that you always get every year. Jason Kelce spoke about the grass and how he loves the smell of the grass. So just mm-hmm. think about that as a player, not really getting that anymore. He has to find other ways to actually cope with smelling the grass being out there on the football field, or actually just even just hitting another player. Like, that's fun in itself because, oh, we're teammates, but we get to go against you and we get to compete against each other. And so that's the whole fun part about football, is that you get to see someone every day that you build a relationship with, and none of the outside noise matters. Everything that happens in his locker room, that's the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
And he won't have that anymore. And so I think that was the tough part about what he was trying to convey to the people when he was talking about him retiring, was that, man, I gave my all to this. And then also, like, he was always the underdog. So having to step it up a notch or prove people wrong was his forte. He always wanted to show you, like, hey, I'm the best center, even though I'm not the biggest or the strongest. He's a 6-time Pro Bowler. He doesn't have exactly that anymore. Oh, we know that he's a Hall of Famer, but I think what gave him some insight was him being able to do his podcast and things of that nature this year. You know, I think that gave him some life to let him know, like, yo, I'm pretty funny. I can do these things, and I can show people the other side of me that they may not have seen before. But still, it's still hard to give up the game that you love.
Yeah. Can I ask you about, you talked about that bubble, Marcus, and at some point the bubble pops, and this is a bubble you've been in since you were a kid, dedicating your life to this one thing. What was that moment like for you transitioning to the next phase? Was there like a certain moment where you remember, like, thinking, what do I do, or an identity crisis type of moment for you?
Yeah, it was an identity crisis moment for me, because in my career, it kind of ended abruptly because I was dealing with some anxiety, some depression while I was playing. And so I really didn't have a true identity outside of football. And usually when I'm talking to players, or if I'm doing a healing circle, a lot of players, what they go through is like a year to 2 year span of really trying to find their purpose outside of football. Because you have to think, when we are done playing, other than us of people saying, like, hey, that's Marcus Smith, the NFL football player, he was a first round draft pick, you want people to start saying, hey, Marcus Smith, the global ambassador, or Marcus Smith, the mental health advocate. You have to start changing the narrative of what people see you as, because you don't play anymore. And that's a tough thing to do, to find out, okay, what do I truly like outside of football? Because, you know, football doesn't last forever. So I would say that, yeah, it was definitely identity crisis. Yeah. I'm praying that Jason doesn't necessarily go through that, because he has some things out there for him that he can do to kind of, like, push him forward and help him along.
And speaking of narrative, Mike, I want to bring you back in the conversation as we wind this down. And you mentioned this in your column recently, that there are really two great speeches in Jason Kelce's career. There's the one we heard yesterday, the very emotional retirement speech, the tearful one. And then there's his speech after the Super Bowl victory at the parade, which was macho and loud and kind of like a professional wrestling promo. And I feel like there is something there that Kelce could give both of those types of speeches and really connect with people, says something about his legacy and I guess what makes him unique as a Philly sports figure. Could you help me explore that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm not sure, Avi, that any athlete who has played professional sports in Philadelphia has connected with the city and the region in the way that Jason did. I think a lot of that has to do with his upbringing. He grew up in suburban Cleveland in an environment, sociologically speaking, sensibility-wise, that is very similar to the Philadelphia area. I think his natural personality allows him to connect with people from any kind of background, any kind of race, creed, anything along those lines. And I also think that Jason learned early on, and this is a hard thing. This is something that even if an athlete knows it, it can be a challenge for him or her to live and behave in accordance with this, which is understanding the mentality, generally speaking, of the Philadelphia sports fan. Mm. The understanding that if you try, people here will love you forever. And if you are honest and upfront about your mistakes, people will understand and accept that. And look, he's a special case in that regard. He's very much in the moment at all times, and he is able to kind of cast mistakes and errors out of his mind in a way that a lot of athletes and a lot of human beings can't. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's a big reason that he connected here as well as he did. And I think those two speeches get to that. You're seeing two sides of the same human being in that, as you said, Avi, that kind of pro wrestler like speech, and then the veil of tears he turns into yesterday.
The vulnerability. That's Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks for joining us today, Mike.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Also, thank you, Marcus Smith II, former Philadelphia Eagles linebacker. His podcast, The Circle of M, is about breaking mental health stigmas. Thank you, Marcus, for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you guys for having me.
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. Despite a 0% approval rating, I'm still your host, Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. I think it's higher than that, Avi.
1%.
Yes.
I just clocked 1% in the latest Monmouth University poll.
I love it. So voters doubt Biden's leadership and favor Trump, Time Siena poll finds. That headline over the weekend in the New York Times spawned an entire news cycle, Avi. Biden doomed? Is Trump inevitable? The pundits were off and running.
And these days, any big poll result also spurs a conversation about polls themselves. Mm-hmm. Look at the sample size. Check the crosstabs. This poll is good. This poll is bad. So let's take a deep breath today and talk about polls.
In our data-hungry age, polls are very good at drawing attention. But are they good at what they claim to measure? And are they good for democracy? To help answer that question, we have a pair of experts. Patrick Murray is founder and director of the Polling Institute at Monmouth University, which is a well-known New Jersey pollster. Patrick, welcome to Studio 2.
It's good to be with you, Sherry.
Here in the studio, we have Matt Graham, an assistant professor at Temple University who studies polling and surveying. Matt, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And so we want to start, Patrick, by asking you to walk us through the process of designing a poll. You pick the topic, but let's build it together. Where would you start and take us through it step by step?
Yeah, well, the question you start with is what's the purpose? Why are you going out there and measuring public opinion to begin with? What's the rationale? When we talk about polls, a lot when we're talking about in the media and the kind of the poll that you led with, which is that Time Siena poll, is a very small proportion, like infinitesimally small proportion of the entire field of survey research, meaning, you know, very little of what we do is a horse race about who's ahead and who's who's behind in an election. What we try to do is measure the public's view on a whole host of issues, whether it's their views of the economy in general, how they deal with, say, the pandemic. There was a lot, we did a lot of work during the pandemic just figuring out, how are you coping with this emotionally? How are you coping with it economically? Are you willing to get the vaccine? Why or why not? These are things that actually feed into the real conversations and real policy decisions that folks make. And then a lot of stuff that you don't even see that's not public because it's being done for government agencies, nonprofits, corporations to better understand what their populations and constituencies are like. And that's the first question we ask is, who do we want to get this from? So if we determine the population, and once we determine the population, we say, is there a way that we can contact that population, whether it's by telephone, by email, an online panel or in person or whatever it is. And then we build the questionnaire around those things. One of the things that it's interesting when we talk about election polling that violates the first principle of any poll that we do is that you've got to know your population before you start. And when you're doing election polling, you don't know the population because it's the people who vote and they haven't voted yet.
Right.
So you're trying to figure that out.
You're trying to guess. So that's
where we start. Right.
So you're trying. So for an election poll, you'd be trying to guess the sort of proportions of who's going to vote.
Well, that's one of the things that you hear about these likely voter models. So the likely voter model is that you take a potential pool of voters, say you start with all registered voters, because you know those are the people who could potentially vote. And then what some pollsters do is add on this kind of, well, let's see if we can use some metrics to figure out which of this population is actually going to turn out to vote. What's going to be the future population of actual voters? And there's not anything real in polling and survey research methodology that tells you how you should do this. And so each pollster is going to do it in a different way. Maybe they'll look at their past voting history and then give them a score based on whether they voted in the past. Maybe they'll just ask them a whole bunch of questions about their likelihood to vote, how enthusiastic they are, how interested they are in the election, and use that to create some sort of index and model where they can give each person a weight or determine a cutoff of who's going to vote. Everybody does it differently. And that's why when we're getting into a more volatile situation in politics like we do today, we get more volatile polling. If the political situation is more volatile, then these add-ons that you're doing to survey methodology are going to be subject to more error than they were in the past when political behavior was a little bit more predictable and a little bit more stable.
So, and then when you get the responses back, and you always see like the end number, 800, 1,000, however many people responded, how do you then weight those responses to end up at the data that the public sees? And Patrick, I'll just stay with you on that one.
Sure. Yeah. So hopefully you don't have to weight it a lot. And what I mean by that is if 20% of the electorate are African-American, then 20% of the sample in your poll should be African-American. And in fact, you want to look at it a little differently or dive into it a little bit more specifically, such as African-American men and women, African-American men and women with or without a college education. And you look at those and you just say, is my sample look like that? If it doesn't look like that, what you do is you create some adjustments to make sure that your sample is properly represented demographically. And we've been doing a pretty good job at that over time with most of the survey research that we do. It's when you get into elections that it gets a little bit more difficult because, again, you're trying to predict an electorate. And sometimes that electorate doesn't look like it looked like the last time around. And so there could be some differences there.
So, Matt, let me bring you into the conversation. Mm-hmm. Matt Graham, assistant professor of political science at Temple. That's often what we focus on, the horse race polls. Those generate huge headlines. But Patrick just said they're very difficult to do. And he alluded to the fact that they're maybe becoming more difficult to do because of volatility in politics. So what's the trajectory of political horse race polling in terms of accuracy right now? Plateauing, declining, improving? Give us a sense of the landscape.
Well, it's interesting, Avi, because there's so much attention focused on the high-profile mistakes in 2016 and 2020.
We remember the bad stuff, like when the weather forecaster said it was going to be cloudy, but it ended up being sunny. We always remember that.
Yeah, yeah, right. But the 2018 and 2022 midterms were the two most accurate election cycles that polling has had since 1998.
Wow,
and
really?
So, you know, the declining response rates and the needing to rely more on waiting as opposed to just being able to take for granted that when you dial random digits, a really large percentage of people are going to pick up the phone. The need to rely on statistical adjustments makes things more volatile in a sense, but in a polarized era like you have today, people have such a clearer sense in their minds of what the parties stand for, and particularly in an election like this where both candidates have been president before, that a nice thing about the situation that we're in these days is that when you ask people which candidate they prefer, they can almost everybody can reliably tell you that piece of information. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so a huge amount of it depends on whether we're able to get those statistical adjustments right. If we can get them right, then polling in a polarized era isn't necessarily any harder than it's been.
Wow. And Patrick, I want to sort of follow up with that and ask the question. I mean, Matt, I'm looking at Matt and I said Patrick, but I wanted to sort of follow up because are the folks being polled, are they being honest? Because there has been questions over the last two presidential elections about the honesty of poll responses. Can you talk about the challenges there?
Yeah, right. So when I hear that question, I think about it through the shy Trump phenomenon that people were worried about. Will somebody who supports an unconventional candidate admit that in a poll? And there's not a lot of evidence that people who preferred Trump or prefer Biden won't tell a pollster that once they get into the survey. But the other way that that can come in is through what we call differential non-response.
Yeah. So I don't want to take the survey at all.
Right. So depending on people's political leanings or what their favorite candidate says about polling or what have you, they may be more or less likely to respond. And that's where we've seen more political differences in the past couple election cycles.
Was that specifically in 16 and 20? Okay. But you said in 18 and 22, and I get Trump was not up for election in those, but it seemed like that wasn't as big a problem, or they were able to adjust for that somehow.
Yeah, and you know, it's hard to speculate about exactly what drove those dynamics. Yeah. And you know, 2024 is going to be its own animal. Whatever you think of Trump, you know that if something's not going his way, he's going to dismiss it. And in the past two cycles that he ran for president, the polls weren't going his way. He dismissed him, and maybe his supporters followed suit to an extent. But right now, you know, he seems to be up in the polling averages. If he takes a different approach to talking about polling than he took last time around, then those dynamics could totally change. And we won't know that until we find out who actually voted after
so
the election's over.
Yeah, and if you're just tuning in, we're talking about polling, asking lots of questions about the issue. Do you trust polls? Do you have issues with polling? You can call us. The number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. You just heard the voice of Matt Graham, a political science professor at Temple University, who's been focusing on his research on political behavior and survey research and polling. Also, Patrick Murray, founder and director of the Polling Institute at Monmouth University, which is a very well-known New Jersey pollster. Patrick, I wanted to ask you a question because there's been multiple opinions that have said the polling system is broken and we have gotten to a place where some groups have decided to opt out of election polling altogether. Others have just been quiet. What are your thoughts on there? Are there major issues with the way polls are conducted these days? And Patrick, are you still with us?
I think we lost Patrick. But let's kick that over to Matt. I think you heard the question, Matt Graham. Are there sort of major six systemic issues with polling right now that we can point to? Or do you think it's just been too volatile to really draw out a trend line here?
Well, the really major systemic issue that has been affecting polling in over the past, couple of decades is the declining response rates in phone surveys. Once upon a time, everybody had, or almost everybody had, a landline, and we weren't so inundated with scammers and polls, frankly. And so you could pretty much count on dialing random digits into a phone, and if 70% of the people on the other end respond and take your poll, you have a pretty good bet that you're going to have a random sample. Yeah. Now, you know, nobody wants to pick up their phone for reasonable reasons, and so pollsters are starting to use a much wider variety of methods than we're used in the past.
Can we talk about some of those? Yeah.
And there are some pretty creative solutions to not being able to count on random digit dialing. Voter registration databases are public records, and so you can try to sample out of that. The U.S. Postal Service keeps a file of all of the addresses, so everybody who has an address with USPS is in their address file. You can send text messages to people's numbers. And so people are trying to sample now out of voter files, out of the USPS address list, out of text messages, and just going online and letting whoever take the survey and hope that, you know, the 30-year-old college-educated person from Nebraska who voluntarily decides to take a survey online is the same as the ones who didn't.
Interesting. Patrick Murray, I think we have you back on the line. Patrick Murray from Monmouth University. I don't know how much of that you heard, but I did want to ask you about this concept of good pollsters and bad pollsters. Because if you go on a website like 538, you will see, for instance, that Monmouth University is very highly regarded by them. And there are other polls that they say are not very reliable, are not very accurate. Is that a real phenomenon? Good pollsters and bad pollsters? Or is it much ado about nothing?
No, there is a real phenomenon about that. And one of the things and one of the reasons why we're ranked highly here at Monmouth is because of transparency, meaning we explain what we do. So if you got a little bit of knowledge about how survey research works, you can read our methodology statements and get a really good sense of how we actually did this. A lot of bad pollsters will not give you any information whatsoever. They won't tell you how they chose the sample. They won't tell you how they asked the questions, which is really a key that the media really need to look at, is how a question is asked as much as how the sample is drawn. Even within some of the methodologies that Matt was talking about, such as the online polls, there are good online polls and there are bad online polls. There are online polls where they create a panel by mailing and invitations to a random sample of addresses that are drawn from that post office file, and then using them to recruit a representative sample and then tracking that representative sample over time. Whereas then there's others where it's just like an opt-in. You go in, you get paid $10 to do a survey because you saw a link on Amazon or something. And those tend to be not so good. And the difficulty with the public is you can't tell the difference.
Yeah. We report on all of them, it seems like. And they all get recirculated on Twitter or your social media platform of choice. And Patrick Murray, you've talked about whether it's sort of responsible to release polling data. You've been self-reflective about this. You know, what's your message to people? Like, what's a responsible way to cover polls, or should we cover polls at all as the media?
Well, what I'm really concerned about is there's the overall issue about, you know, just releasing, you know, the media jumping on any number that's sexy to them that generates clicks. But in specifically around election polling, the thing that I worry about is that we've reduced this to some kind of sports betting, predictive market that we want. All we want to know is Will candidate Y, how much is candidate Y ahead of candidate X or vice versa? And that's the only number that we want to know. We don't want to know what issues are important. We don't want to know what motivates people. We don't want to know how much faith they have in the institution of voting and what they're going out to do. All we want to know is that margin between candidate X and candidate Y. And that horse race number, as we call it, is just, I think, a real difficulty. And one of the things that I've done over the last couple of years is that I've changed the way that we ask the question. I don't ask a standard horse race question in our general election polls. I ask, how likely are you to support each of the candidates individually? And that gives us a floor and a ceiling. How many people have ruled out a candidate? And then we ask follow-up questions about why. And part of the reason why I did this is, one, to get away from this kind of horse race idea, and two, also to get away from polls having more of an influence on what people are going to do.
That self-fulfilling prophecy part of it.
I wanted to follow up with you, Patrick, because you wrote, the American Republic is at an inflection point. Public trust in public institutions and our fundamental democratic processes is abysmal. Honest missteps get conflated with fake news. I want you to talk about the ethical issues here, because is it the chicken or the egg? How are these polls influencing voters? And Matt, I'd love for you to weigh in on that, because we're getting, how responsible is it to put out some of these polls when an election day is weeks away?
Well, you know, Avi, you just talked a moment ago about polls being a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
And in a way, the dynamic can actually flip around to polls being a self-defeating prophecy. You know, as
well, because people take their foot off the gas pedal, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, as people, we are, you know, unless you're 2 year old, two years old, you're a social creature. You're thinking all the time about what other people are going to do. And when people are exposed to election forecasts about this candidate, who's going to win, that candidate's going to win, that affects people's behavior. And people aren't always as sensitive as we would like them to be to, oh, a 60% chance of going one way means that there's a 40% chance of going the other way.
Yeah.
And so there's some good evidence that around the 2016 election, left-leaning people were more likely to consume poll forecasts from the major forecasters. They were overconfident in Hillary Clinton's chances of winning. And people who were very confident that she would win were less likely to vote. We can't quite see the counterfactual. We can't be sure that the forecasting was pivotal in that case. But all of these numbers that we put out there end up having a social impact. And it's hard to stop when whoever does it is going to get the clicks.
Yep. As we wrap up here, Patrick, I just wanted to ask you, is there something the media could do differently here? Because we're grappling with this effect that the poll numbers have some sort of impact, right? And so in about 30 seconds, you know, is there something that the media could do differently?
Yeah, they can report more on the actual issues that we ask about in these polls. I mean, I did an analysis of the media coverage of our polls in Pennsylvania back in 2022. And the number of stories that actually covered some of the issue questions rather than the candidate questions was abysmal. And that was, it's really a media's choice. We put out a lot of information there. And again, the only thing that tends to get coverage is who's
the top line number.
Right.
Well, that's Patrick Murray, founder and director of the Polling Institute at Monmouth University. Patrick, thanks for being with us today on Studio 2.
My pleasure.
Matt Graham, assistant professor at Temple University. And Matt, maybe there's a conversation another time about all the other types of polling and surveying that's done, which is fascinating and you've looked into. But for now, thank you for coming on Studio 2.
Yeah, don't get me started. Thank you for having me.
We don't have the time today. It's another day.
And that wraps up our show. Thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks was our engineer for today. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I am Cherry Gregg.
100% certainty, this is the end of the show today. I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, thanks for joining us.